how large? And I said, well, probably 1,000 square meters. They said, how many are you? I said, we are two. I'm pretty sure it will grow fast.
It sounds amazing, having the vector and then the antibody produced locally. How well does it work, though?
You come from somebody in a wheelchair to somebody who can do top sports, and that is in one career.
How do you manage to just still keep going and then going again?
I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
Hi. I'm your host, Philip, and welcome to a new episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. And today I'm in a very rainy Amsterdam to talk with Sander van de Vent. And Sander has really an impressive track record, both as a professor, as an operational biotech founder, and also as a VC. In 1998, he actually co-founded what is now uniQure, and which actually brought the first gene therapy product drug on the market. Then he went on to co-found Forbion, leading VC, and also big success story, Dezima. And now he's back at it, again founding a company, Vectory or Vector Y, again in the gene therapy space with some new technology. We will talk obviously about Vectory and also about the gene therapy field in general, especially what's missing still to make it big. So let's head upstairs and talk with Sander. All right, welcome to the show, Sander.
Well, nice to be here.
Cool. It's great it worked out. I mean, I mentioned I made a post about the Series A, and I mentioned I will try to have you on the show. And it's great it worked, and we managed to get it just by the end of the year. So, yeah. Thanks for taking the time. I mean, it's a busy time before Christmas. So I want to start with actually the Series A. I mean, 129 million euros, I think. Let's say 130. I mean, it's, I think, the largest Series A this year, one of the largest ever. I mean, European standards is really big. But I've heard also it took a bit longer to close than expected. Can you maybe share what happened?
Yeah, so basically, I think there were two factors here. So the company started as a gene therapy company, advertising basically it being a gene therapy company. And as we developed the technology, it turned out that most of the value actually is in the ability to address difficult issues in proteostasis in neurons. Actually, from the delivery side of things, like, we still like the delivery being a gene therapy because it's a one-off therapy that will work for a very long period of time, which is really nice when you do that in the CNS. The focus shifted more and more to the business side of thing, what exactly we are expressing. And so, if you look at the efforts here in the company, by far the most effort actually is in the binder technology and the ability to distinguish between misfolded and non-misfolded native proteins, natively folded proteins. And so we actually found in the TDP43 ALS program that there were some unique features here, that is that at the same time you can address a gain of tox problem, whereas you also have an important loss of function problem. And that put us on a really nice place. And so, yeah, some of the investors who looked at the company early looked at it like, there we have another gene therapy company doing a sort of orphan ALS approach or something like that. To the newer investors who came in later or looked at it later, deciding, wow, this is a neat technology and they can really do it. And if they can do it in ALS, they can do it in other CNS diseases. So that is basically the shift of perception that we got at Vectory.
And I guess with that shift also means also the potential is bigger as well.
Yeah, because, just to give you an example, in ALS, of course, you have really good data for SOD1 now, and there's academic data on FOS. But those are the genetic forms of ALS, and together, all the genetic forms of ALS together are maybe 7% of ALS.
Okay.
And the technology that we developed is for all sporadic. So sporadic seems like the more rare form, but actually is more than 95% of, 93 or 95% of ALS. So the market is enormously larger also for our product than it is for product targeting SOD1.
Actually, that's good. I mean, I had some question on ALS because I think, I mean, it's a huge unmet medical need. I don't think there's anything really on the market right now. And I think that there were some failures, I'd say, or some things were blocked. I think, I don't remember the exact name, but somewhere were blocked. So can you expand a bit there of like, how will you position yourself compared to what's in development at the moment? Or
Sure. So first of all, the market, so ALS, people think about it as a sort of rare disease.
Yeah.
But the odds of somebody in the Western world developing ALS are about 1 in 340. Yeah. So I always tell people, you know, if you board a regular train, then somebody in that train will get ALS. So it's not that uncommon, actually. So the market is pretty large. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that in the last probably 5 years or so, 5-6 years, it has become apparent why actually motor neurons die in sporadic ALS. And it turns out that it's a protein which is very much involved in the splicing of mRNAs in motor neurons.
Yeah.
Now, neurons splice RNAs in many more transcripts than other cells. To give you an example, we have done some of these analyses, and so of the 20,000 genes that you obviously have in any cell, but certainly also in a motor neuron, you have like 150,000 transcripts.
Okay.
And so they need to be correctly spliced. And TDP43 is the key component there that is in the spliceosome, the key protein that binds to these RNAs and directs correct splicing. So we found that 1/3 of that complete transcriptome, so we're talking about 50,000 or whatever, transcripts are dysregulated when TDP43 goes wrong. So that gives you also the answer why it's so difficult to develop something in ALS, because we do know many of the downstream...
You're hitting everything.
So right. So
hitting everything.
Companies have tried to do like STATMIN2 or UNC13A or all these other genes that are definitely dysregulated and definitely associated with pathology in ALS. But it's only one of so many.
Yeah.
So we actually correct about 80% of that complete mispliced transcriptome, just restoring nuclear TDP43.
Wow. And just to go on the technology, I mean, you say about vectorized, I mean, that's where the name comes from, so vectorized antibodies. I'm curious on really how and how well it works. I mean, it sounds amazing, like having the vector and then the antibody mm-hmm. produced locally or in the cell. I mean, but how well does it work though, Eddie?
So some companies are also under the umbrella of vectorized antibodies. They make antibodies that are secreted, and they work outside of the cell.
So Voyager and most of it, they are
exactly
probably one of the leading ones, almost at least.
They are in that business, basically. Yeah. We are developing antibodies, and actually some academic groups have done it, and Voyager has done it in the past also, that stay inside the cell.
Okay.
And so you can put them in different formats. So we have used single-chain AVs. We have also worked with VHH binders. And those can be nicely expressed long-term in animals. I think, you know, the longest is a couple of months that we have now, but I expect these to express years after a single dose.
Yeah.
And so that works nicely. Now it comes to the part where what you bind and how you actually then get rid of it. So in ALS, you have aggregates of TDP43. Normally, 80% of the TDP43 is within the nucleus, and that's where it mainly works because of the splicing aspect and so on and so forth. It does more than that, but let's focus on that. And then only 20% is in cytoplasm, and there's a recirculation of TDP43 from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. So we know that process quite well. But if you have aggregation formation in the cytoplasm and you get placed, so to say, TDP43, then you lose it in the nucleus. Okay. And also that circulation is then disturbed because the aggregates actually aggregate more and more. TDP43 is like a gluey lump of TDP43 that stays there, and so that interferes with that recirculation. So the binders that we make need to get rid of those aggregates. We actually developed a whole lot of binders targeting the complete protein. So there was a lot of work has been done there. And so we first...
You said that's why most of the people work on the binders. Actually.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so we first defined where actually to target that that protein. Yeah. So then we came up with a binder that did it very well. And we actually found out why. Because it binds to a part of the protein that is not accessible in the normal forms. Okay. But it is accessible when you have aggregation. And so that's one part of it. And then, of course, binding alone is not enough. You need to get it somewhere. And so those large aggregates actually then need to get
degraded
by autophagy.
Yeah.
And if you have smaller misfolded proteins, it's mainly through the proteasome.
Yeah.
And then also one other pathway you can think about is the lysosome. So at the same time, we made what we made dagrons. So those are motifs that we can link with our binders. And the dagrons actually instruct the whole complex to go somewhere. So it can be, you know, to autophagy, it can be to the proteasome. And we actually have binders now that we engineered to have a dual function. Basically, it says if you bind to an aggregate autophagy, but if you bind to a misfolded protein, it needs to go to the proteasome. So all that work also was done in parallel. So we call the binders VACTABs, and these dagrons we call dagrons. Yeah. And so the ones that are engineered with a dagron we call a VECTRON. Yeah. So it's a little bit because otherwise we have to always explain. And that works amazingly well.
Yeah.
So the binders actually are expressed at the through levels, the trough levels, or the, you know, the levels that we have in those cells are really low. They're so low that you sometimes even have to go to technologies like LC-MS to basically even to show that they are there.
Yeah.
But they function like very, very well. So they almost completely normalize the phenotype of ALS motor neurons. So if you look at, you know, electrophysiology, or you look at dendrite length, or you look at signaling, or you look at, all kinds of aspects, survival, and all kinds of aspects of health.
You restore them.
They're completely to normal. Okay.
That's me. I mean, yeah, okay. So if I follow, so you have your vector, your gene therapy vector, you will insert the gene in a certain cells, which then express and make express some of your binders intracellular, and then you can target the aggregates, bind them together, and then lead to the autophagy and restore the phenotype.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, but it's not only autophagy. To the proteasome or proteasomally degrade them. We have a binder that's neutral.
Yeah.
And so if you put a different dagron on it, it will start doing different things.
Mm.
So if it's neutral, it binds to an aggregate, does nothing. But if we engineer it with an autophagy dagron, then it will instruct autophagy or proteasomal degradation. It will instruct that as well. And
so you can really engineer the binders. I'm curious, you mentioned VH, or what's specific in the binders? I mean, just coming from, I worked a bit with molecular partners with some alternative proteins, and I know one of the big challenges with antibodies was it's just usually too large. Also, a bit harder to really engineer precisely, especially when you talk intracellular. So, how do you, what are you actually using? Like,
well, there are a couple of things here. So, the whole development of these binders is very different from antibodies. I've worked with antibodies for a long time, and to start with, how do you select binders that specifically recognize misfolded proteins? Because the moment you start making these proteins as an antigen, for example, they're always misfolded. They're in the, you know, they're never in the correct configuration. So you really have to do this on high throughput cell systems. And so here in the lab, we actually have a high throughput screening system for example, U2S cells, but also in iPS-derived human cells. It could be motor neurons or median spiny striatal neurons or cortical neurons. We have all that here. And also glial cells, like we have astrocytes here and all that sort of. We have everything here. So muscle, we can do all that. So
this floor and the other floor and the other building.
Right, okay. So it's all there. So the screening is very different. But also the pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics totally different because, you know, in the periphery, you would like to have, you know, a sort of, you know, at least a significant trough level. But here, you know, the turnover actually is pretty fast for these small binders. Talk about hours or something like that. But within the cell, it doesn't matter. Actually, they're extremely active. You can hardly measure them, and they're highly, highly potent. So the whole pharmacokinetic model is also totally different from what it is outside cells.
And I guess they're produced constantly.
That's the point.
Over time, yeah. You don't need a massive quantity because it's
exactly.
Over time.
Exactly. And then, of course, how you dose.
Tell me what specifically are those binders like?
Well, we do have them in different formats. So we do have for our TDP-43 program, it's a single gen FE, and for our Huntington program, it's a VHH engineered with a Dagron, and all that sort of stuff. So it depends. There are some arguments why to choose one over the other for a certain program, but you know there are. Also aspects, you know, in what compartment do we want that binder to show up? So if we don't want, for example, the binder to show up in the nucleus, and clearly for TDP43 that would be, you know, not something that we want, then we a single chain FE format, you know, doesn't go to the nucleus, but the VHH might. And so we do have some aggregates that are nuclear, and for that program, we would use a different binder. So these are just some considerations.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I'm curious just from also a bit comparing it to different technology. I mean, when I heard about it and looked over, I thought right away about mRNA delivery as well. I mean, you could deliver instruction to produce a binder as well.
Yeah.
But I guess then the window to produce is way less long or less over time. So for ALS, you will not have this like ongoing production of binders, which will fix it really long term with a single injection, or you would need like several injections.
Yeah. So that's why actually coming to the gene therapy aspect here. So we are open to any non-viral delivery or even use the VACTAPs as VACTAPs, you know, engineer them in any way or format. Right now, for the brain programs, there are two things. First of all, in ALS, we really, really specifically need to target motor neurons. So we have a whole vector strategy to do that. And I'm pretty confident that with the vector we have now here in-house, we achieve that goal. And then it's a single administration, and there will be very long-term expression based on what we have seen, for example, in the Huntington project that we developed at UniCure years. So that's a good thing. With siRNAs, of course, the specificity of the transduction will be, you know, more, you know, common. I've seen really good distribution data, by the way, with silencing RNAs now in the brain, but it would be a repeated dosing. And the problem with repeated dosing is that, you know, a lot of the troubles that you now see in the Roche program or with Spinraza or other ASO programs is really, you know, increases in NFL, enlargement of the ventricles and all that sort of stuff, which probably is related to, you know, it might be related to the repeated dosing of the ASOs. Yeah. So, yeah, we really don't want to get in those troubles. So for now, for these programs in the brain, we use AAV technology. But we are open to any other delivery technology.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of also downsides to AAV.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, in general, it's one of the bottlenecks. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, to come back to that, when we started this company, I've been producing AAV since 2004. Yeah. And, you know, we did two commercial products, yeah. Klybera and Hemgenix. And so I've been scaling it up and I've been, you know, involved quite a lot with the technology itself. So here in this company, when we started, we said, well, we want actually even a next gen. So we want to get to 90% full particles. We want to have the particles filled with the correct and intact genomes and all that. And then we want to produce this all the way to a 2,000 liter scale.
Yeah.
So that the cost of goods come down and that we can do hundreds and hundreds of patients from a single run. And that's the process we have.
Yeah.
So
I saw on the manufacturing, you already claim on the 2,000 liters already? So
no, we haven't done it, but we are doing it now.
Okay.
So we're at the process now to here in the company, we only go to 50 liters.
Yeah.
And so then we transfer it to a CDMO,
yeah.
With exactly the same equipment, uses our materials in our process, and then our people are there, and that's how we're scaling up now.
Okay. Yeah. And I was on the, what you mentioned also on the AAV, I mean, I think it rapidly gets pretty technical as well, but what I've seen is one of your poster or paper on, you really can engineer the capsid and have some like tissue-specific peptides on the side that you can basically target certain type of tissue, I guess, in the brain, I guess for ALS is super important. And at the same time, you also showed that that the capsid can cross the blood-brain barrier, so you don't even need to inject directly in the brain.
Yeah, there are several companies have shown that. So, yeah. And also in primates. So we only showed it ex vivo, so we don't even have primate data. We are generating those data, but
wasn't it on pigs, the data you showed? Was on
yeah, but it's not in vivo. That was in a model. But, you know, Capsigen and Dino and Voyager, and they have all these capsids that can do that.
Okay.
So we are not unique there. But the one thing I think we're unique at is the structural engineering part. So we basically choose the target, and then we make a peptide ligand, and then we screen that ligand in different formats. And that ligand we engineer in the outer capsid directly in such a conformation that it retains that binding capacity. So you can actually, if you work that way, you can work much more targeted than if you do a million or a billion library with random mutations, and then you have to select back. Yeah. And also the optimization is more straightforward. So yeah, we've done that, and we have now a whole library that actually is being tested also with novel binding sites.
Okay. That's nice. Yeah, I like that. On the you mentioned on the pipeline, so you have ALS, Huntington's, Parkinson's, but they're all in preclinical / in cells at the moment. So
yeah.
So you found ways to then IND and even reach first human.
Well, for ALS, I mean, we've done the TDP43 mouse model, and we've done multiple models going from mouse to pig to primate. And we're now at the stage that we are in. We'll shortly discuss pre-IND, have a pre-IND meeting with the FDA, and the plan is to complete our primate tox study next year, end of next year, and to have an IND meeting and to start clinical trial in 2025 in Q1. And with ALS, of course, the point is that you fairly rapidly get to an endpoint because the disease is rapidly progressive and. So we expect, and then there's a whole biomarker strategy, which is very much linked to the exact TDP43 pathology, because the consequences of this missplicing as a consequence of loss of function of TDP43 are that you also get peptides that shouldn't be there, that are mispliced, actually the result of missplicing. And those peptides you can measure. You can measure them in CSF, you can measure them in patients. So if you then, if you restore splicing, you should get rid of those faulty peptides.
Yeah.
So all that work is ongoing. So I actually expect that if it all works well, we will rapidly see the biomarker change.
Yeah.
And we do have a whole panel of those. And then, of course, there are usual biomarkers like NfL And of course, there's a motor score also that we are following that is rapidly progressive. And so
I start to understand also what's behind the platform and also where's the potential and also where, I mean, sounds like you've pretty solid already knowledge slash data really on the cap side, on the binders, on the disease, on exactly where you target, where's the trial going. You already have solid preclinical data. Because I mean, my question, I mean, basically what's to explain the money raised basically at a preclinical stage. I mean, it's, of course, I mean, you're in Farovion and everything. You can put out a bit more, but still there's limits to a preclinical, let's say, evaluation or how much you can really raise. But now I start to really understand that seems like a lot of the pillars are basically very solid from the foundations. And then it's about executing on the clinical trial.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, you know, we said, listen, I mean, where are we going to finance towards?
Yeah.
And the discussion we had with our investors, and in the end, everybody was very much on the same page. You know, value you create here with clinical results.
Mm.
So we wanted this financing for sure to get to meaningful clinical results for our lead program, which is VTX2, is TP43 in ALS. But we are also bringing the Huntington program to IND and two other programs in the same proteostasis paradigm towards DC. So, you know, if you have a product that succeeds in ALS, of course, the upside is, you know, much larger than the investment now.
Yeah.
But also if the technology really functions like a platform technology, because we have excellent data in Huntington models also.
Yeah.
So if that also translates into clinical efficacy in Huntington's, then, you know, and
that's a multiplier.
It's a multiplier, yeah.
Especially, I mean, CNS still today, there's still, I mean, there are lots of, let's say, failures or big failures, but the need is so, so high that, yeah, if you have something that works, I guess.
But, you know, if you look at the where investments are going now, then there's a sharp drop in oncology and there's a sharp rise in, metabolic obesity, of course, but also in CNS. So it's really where the money is going now.
It's interesting. And I saw LSP invested through, what was it, one of the dementia funds,
right?
Which they started maybe a bit, I don't know, earlier than the trend, but they're there. Or there's some other VCs who have also dementia, or I think the Dementia Discovery Fund in the UK, which I guess, I mean, I was watching it, I think, I don't know when they started exactly, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where was still, at least to me, maybe a bit early, or it was not clear, okay, is that now, but maybe now it's the timing. I mean, I guess it's the goal also of a VC to be a bit earlier than too late.
they did very well, I think. And also the ALS Investment Fund put quite some money in this company as well. And I know them almost from the start because we were looking at ALS investments, and at Unicure we had a GDNF program that at some point in time was considered to be potentially something we should try in ALS. And so already in those days, I was talking about that.
Yeah. I think that's the last point I want to talk about is more on the team as well. I mean, obviously you've co-founded Unicure, and then you even went back in 2017 as kind of acting CSO. And I think then your now CSO was a head of M&D, I don't remember the exact title, at Unicure as well. So I guess, I mean, the team is definitely very solid. But I'm curious also how it's like, what's the story behind some of the team joining, or what's the relationship with Unicure?
In general, of course, there are things like non-compete, and I don't think Unicure would like all their people to come here. Actually, they're laying off people now, like 130 or something like that. And I have a good relationship because actually they they're actively helping people find new jobs, including here. Yeah. So I have some people actually that worked at Unihero that work now here as of shortly. The other thing is that, we started this company with two people, me and another.
In 2020.
Yeah, no. I quit Unicure and then I had a temporary job in China, as you probably know, when it was all about building an AAV manufacturing facility in Suzhou. And that all went very well. I wrote a little bit of a blog about that on LinkedIn, being in quarantine and what have you. And then I came back and we knocked here on the door where we are now. To say, well, guys, do you have some lab for rent? And they say, well, yeah, how large? And I said, well, probably 1,000 square meters or something like that. They said, how many are you? I said, we are two, but I'm pretty sure we'll grow fast. So we didn't get to 1,000 square meters, but I think we started with maybe 300 or so. And we were like a magnet. People were calling us up spontaneously, or people really wanted to join. People left really good paying jobs to be in this company. And people actually, the founders invested their own money in the company and all that. So that's how it started.
Including you, I guess you also invested.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And, the first thing actually I did is I went to the hardware store to get some wrenches and stuff, to put the tables together and the Wi-Fi and what have you. And so that's literally how we started.
That's crazy.
But people really came here because there were so many people that we worked with in the past who knew us. They really want, the people like to work here. We have 15 nationalities here and we have about, 65 FTEs or so. Yeah. And the median age is 32. We have 60% women, so it's a joyful group here, with all these people coming from all over the place to actually do their best job here, and that's how it works.
I guess you're hiring also actively, at least I've seen on your...
Yeah, we just basically put out our vacancies, of course.
Yeah. People are listening to us are looking for a job. But also, from what you said also, what's pretty... amazing. Also, Amsterdam or Netherlands in general. There's quite a deep expertise in gene therapy in general via Unicure, but also a lot of CDMO manufacturers in the space. Can you expand a bit there, how you see that, or how it compares maybe to other clusters, let's say in Europe?
Yeah, I think, you have fantastic clusters all over the place. You talk about Genopole, if you talk about gene therapy, all over the place, and particularly also in UK, of course, enormous clusters of knowledge and know-how. I think, in the Benelux, actually, we're getting our act together. Of course, with everything in Belgium going on in Ghent and Leuven and what have you. And, Argenix, a company that we started with when there were five people at Forbion, we invested in it. And what is it now? It's, 20 billion market cap. Oh, okay. So these have become companies that are much larger than KLM Air France or Air France KLM or companies like that. People just don't know it. But, the cluster in Leiden is, I was in the board there because I was a professor at Leiden also. I was in the board of that cluster, and there's more than 100 companies there. BMS is building a huge cell therapy CAR T-cell factory there. Kite, of course, they're here. So, yeah, there's quite a lot of that. But here in Amsterdam, it started later. And it's smaller, but we're getting there. We work with some companies here on site when it comes to promoter technology, for example, and it's growing fast. So yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about the environment.
And also when you look at the map, Leiden,
It's nothing else.
So I mean, as far as the pole to the center of the
20 minutes. Yep.
Yeah. I landed in Schiphol yesterday. It's crazy how close it is. And the train, everything connected. Yeah. That's nice. I was always surprised about this, like, especially in the Netherlands. You had a few companies like Unicure, but that's a lot of like bigger pharma had their gene and cell therapy here from a manufacturing or from development. It was always pretty like established.
J&J, Crucial, and of course we have Genmab, and then, you know, as I said, I mean, BMS, a big time now. Astellas also in Leiden. So yeah, there's quite a lot. Yeah.
On the gene therapy field, if we zoom out a bit, I'm curious what you think about the CRISPR approval. Recently.
So gene therapy. I came to the conclusion that the promise of gene therapy. So people present you a slide deck, and the first deck says there are 5,000 genetic diseases, and we can target them with la virus. That doesn't work. So we already know that it's difficult, and you need to know what you're doing. And so we are not doing gene replacement, for example, any longer. Mm-hmm. We're just not doing that. So that's not
because it's too complex.
Yeah, it's often very complex and really, not so easy to do. So, at Unicure, we started already a long time ago with silencing. And so there was actually a press release this morning from Unicure that had some positive news in the Huntington program. I think so gene therapy can be very useful for all kinds of things. And particularly now with the antibody technology that we have, we can tackle things that are very hard to tackle with small molecules or silencing technology. So, the next new thing, of course, is gene editing or things like that. So, with CRISPR technology, the hurdles are simple. So it's delivery. For many of the diseases that they're targeting, you need to have an even spread of the repair. For example, if you look at cardiac indications, you cannot just repair 1 in 10 cardiomyocytes when it goes to conductance, because you will induce arrhythmias actually if you do that. So delivery is a big one. And then of course with CRISPR-Cas based technologies, the construct is very large. So at Forbion, we've been looking at space quite extensively, and we passed on many of those. But with recombinases, with this company Seamless, with relatively small constructs that have no guide DNAs or whatever, you can actually do the same. So we became interested in that. So I really believe that those technologies at some point in time will, of course they work ex vivo. That's a big one. But in vivo, that they will start to work in vivo.
Nice. We had Roger Novak on the show, and one thing that struck me is how he said, CRISPR, of course, the potential and whatever you can do is basically a dream technology, and you could do a lot of things. But they really focused on ex vivo, only ex vivo, and something a bit more easier to do and to execute and to make the trial, versus some other CRISPR companies where tried in vivo right away, and it's just way too complex. So I think it goes into what you are saying as well.
There are proposals like we're going to CRISPR all the HIV out of people, and that's just crazy.
Maybe in 20, 30, 50 years. And I'm curious, what's your view on the, let's say, from a commercial success, from a market point of view, because gene therapy, so far, there's clinical trials, you have approvals, but then when it goes to commercial, in the US, it's a bit better. In Europe, I think it's limited, but what?
Yeah, we need to think about that better. I think Hemgenics, if you do a pharmacoeconomic model, it's quite clear that if you treat somebody with hemophilia B early on and it works like for 10 years, then even if you have a crazy price for the product, it's, you win. So the healthcare system does win, because you know,
but,
these.
Yeah, but why is the healthcare system not buying it more than?
Because people just are not thinking about it. So you know, if I say here in the Netherlands, a gene therapy product will cost 1 or 2 million or anything like that, everybody says that's crazy, and you know, the healthcare system cannot afford that. But if I just tell people that, and what about some patients with hemophilia that cost 300,000 a year just in product?
What would
and then I'm not even calculating that these people, you know, cannot work, and that that they need surgery and all extra costs. And so, you know, 300,000 every year, that you know, that is a lot of money over 10 years. It's 3 million, right? So people just don't do those basically calculations. And our healthcare system is not, you know, basically, you know, but maybe in France now with the thalassemias, they actually calculated how much a thalassemia patient cost to the healthcare system in France. There are quite a lot of them, of course, in France because of the Mediterranean migration. And so actually they came to the conclusion that it would be much, much, much better for them to go for gene therapy for that disorder than to pay for all the you know, all the extra costs that these patients bring. So we need to have healthcare systems and leaders that actually think about this in a much more relaxed manner and also in a much more informed manner.
But from what you say, I mean, and I heard that many times, I mean, the case is pretty clear, as in, like, I mean, 10 times 300,000 versus 1 or 2 million. It's not like super complicated math or whatever. Like, but so I'm curious, I mean, as a payer, they can also, I mean, it's their job to understand it or like to do it. So why? I don't get where it's like really blocking. And because I hear the same math already, let's say 5 years ago, was already the same, let's say, argument, but I don't see necessarily payers like paying more, acting more.
Yeah,
is it me? Like,
no, yeah, you're correct. I mean, and the most frustrating part of it is the lack of any vision. And you know, I've been here for a long time now. We did the first Remicade patient. It was infused in Amsterdam in 1991, so that's a long time ago. And there we had exactly the same discussion. So people were saying, yeah, you know, you can treat Crohn's disease with steroids and with azathioprine. And why are we now going for a treatment that at that point in time would cost like 35,000 a year? I mean, it's now much cheaper, of course. But then, you know, everybody started realizing that actually, with the old treatment, steroids and azathioprine, we never had complete remissions, actually, never ever. And so that's a complete different therapy had hit. And you know, everybody now is of course treated with those kinds of drugs. The same holds true for when we started working on natalizumab, or now with ocrelizumab. If you have MS and you're treated with the regular stuff, it's basically waiting until you hit the wheelchair. That's what you get. With ocrelizumab and ofatumumab, those new drugs, there's zero relapse, almost nothing. And so, you know, these are completely different approaches. And by the way, I can give you a little bit of an anecdote there. And I was closely involved with natalizumab, and I knew about ofatumumab because I was my friend is Jan van der Winkel, who is basically first developed that at Genmab. And of course, went to Novartis. But my wife basically got MS like 6 years ago, quite suddenly, and we are actually mountain biking in the Alps and stuff like that. You know, very fit, and bang, you know, she went out actually, and had severe problems, couldn't see, and all that sort of stuff. And then we went here, and then it's like, yeah, you know, you can do this, you can do that. I said, no, we're just doing what I think, you know, works. And we started immediately with natalizumab because that was available then. Okay. And she, you know, she completely, almost completely normalized. And then when ocrelizumab came, I said, well, ocrelizumab clearly is better than natalizumab. Yeah. You need to take that. So that's about I think the cost is about 35,000 a year or so for ocrelizumab here in the Netherlands. And I do this.
What's the companies behind?
It's Roche.
Roche.
Yeah.
And the other one?
Ovatumumab, Novartis. Yeah, of course, they're fighting their little Swiss battle. But they're both good, eh? So probably ovatumumab might be a little better even than ocrelizumab, but they're both very, very good. And so I do these lectures, and I had a meeting at the economy of the Ministry of Health here in the Netherlands. I just showed them this. My wife is a professor of pediatric infectious diseases. She has a big lab. She makes money. She pays tax and all that sort of stuff. So I did the commercial case of my wife, and I could actually calculate that it is much better for the Dutch taxpayer or for the Dutch government or whatever to have treated my wife for 35,000 than not to have treated her because in 6 years, in her case, she would have been in a wheelchair. So I mean, but it, you know, people just come to me and they say, wow, you know, that's really interesting what you said, and but la la la. But nobody's taking any action.
Yeah,
so that's really what worries me. Yeah.
Oh. Crazy story. Makes me think also about how beautiful and how life-changing some of the biotech products developing are. I mean, it's the example of your is crazy. Like,
Philip, I became an internist in 1987. And so I do have some slides actually that I made in those days about rheumatoid arthritis. There was a young woman, 30 years, in a wheelchair, completely with all these deformations. I have a slide about HIV, the HIV that we're seeing. Just horrible. I have a slide of a patient with hemophilia in those days, with enormous swollen joints and whatever because of the bleeds. And if you... You know, I'm a cyclist. I like to cycle, and so a couple of years ago I was in Tuscany, and there was a lady cycling with me really competitively. Actually, she had been in the British squad, I think, actually for the coming out nationally, and she was on Remicade because of rheumatoid arthritis, and she was basically cycling like crazy. And then you come from somebody in a wheelchair to somebody who can do top sports, right?
Yeah.
And that's is in one career.
Yeah.
And so people just don't realize how much things have improved. And then I'm thinking back, why have these things improved? Is it because we have better doctors? Is it because we have nicer hospitals or better ministries of health or ministers of health? No. It's 100% because we have better medicines, 100%. So people need just to realize that.
Yeah. Amazing. I like that. It's great. It's a perfect shift also to yourself, to the personal story. I remember I asked you in 2017, but I think I want to get a bit into this again, and I think it connects exactly to what you're saying. You're really having these different hats as in like professor, biotech founder, but not just scientific founder or professor founder, but also really executive, and at the same time VC. I guess from what you explain as well, you've seen, I guess, a lot of things that works in the lab, but it gets never translated and never really reaches the patient. So I can imagine, I think that's also a bit what you told me, that it was pretty natural for you to push and go towards there. And even at some point you were raising money, but you wanted to see the other side. And also when you have the control of, there's a pile of money and you can deploy it, it also makes you act differently. Can you kind of maybe reflect on all of that?
So to come back, you know, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. So I've done fundamental science. I was a scientist at Rockefeller University, and then I was trained as a, I've done a lot of virology in already in the early 80s, basically doing molecular biology in the very early days that you have to do everything. You had to do everything yourself. Yeah. You had to make your restriction enzymes yourself in the cold room and stuff like that. So then I was trained as a doctor, internist, gastroenterologist and all that. And then I got involved in drug development and, you know, seen quite some success there. And on the antibody side, the antisense oligonucleus, nucleotide side, the gene therapy side. And then, you know, got the opportunity to become one of the founders of Forbion. And actually before that, actually already founded, of course, Unicure.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, some other companies. So I really am very lucky because I've seen it from all sides.
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, you have to think about, you know, what drives you. Why do you do the stuff you do? And so I've for 20 years I've seen patients. Okay, so patients that are very very sick, and for which we could do nothing. And particularly the worst probably was HIV because we had a lot of that in Amsterdam, and I was in the smack in the middle of it. And we could do absolutely nothing for these patients. And then later, you know, Crohn's disease, you know, 100% of patients almost with Crohn's disease got surgery, and 25% of them almost and always ended with a stoma. With that's really bad if you're a young girl, 25, you have a stoma. That I've seen that a lot. And then, ALS and MS and all disease. So I was seeing patients in the outpatient clinic and often couldn't do a lot. And so that's why in 2004, actually, I made the decision to switch completely, because until 2004, I was also in the clinic. And I was thinking, you know, where can I contribute more to the health and the benefit of people, of patients, being sitting here doing, you know, 20 patients in a shift in the outpatient department, or developing something. And I thought, well, probably with developing stuff, it would be better. So, and then, you know, we did Glybera, we did Hemgenics, we did this program, of course, in Huntington's, and of course, New Amsterdam Pharma with CETP inhibitors, and, you know, many different things that we did, I think, will benefit patients quite a lot. And if you think back and you think, you know, how many patients now have been treated with anti-TNF in one way or the other, it's a lot, right? More than I ever could have seen in the outpatient clinic.
Yeah.
So that is the good thing about, I think, where I'm now.
Yeah. I was about to ask you, if you look back, if you do the math, it's always also, I guess you... Yeah, I mean, you have an impact, but when you are treating a patient, you have also kind of a direct impact, and you need also people to treat patients, and you need doctors as well to deliver the drugs and to do all the following. But I guess for you, it's really clear that you had more impact by developing the drugs than by... But
I think so, yeah.
At the same time, you also got, I guess, I mean, there's always some luck involved in biotech,
yeah.
As in like, I mean, the failure rate is just so high. In your case, it's not only luck, of course, but
involved,
and it's amazing that you managed to be involved in 2, 3, 4 approved drugs within not even 20 years. It's very rare, actually.
You always think back and you think, you know, what actually was really career changing, or you know, what were the big things. So one was actually that I was lucky to run into a promoter, for my PhD project, who was really a visionary. So he was, for all his PhDs, actually, there was you really have to go here or there, and that usually would be the United States or whatever, or other places. But, he had more than 100 PhDs, and he has died, but I think his offspring is like, I think we had a sort of gathering reunion, and there were like 30 or 40 professors who came out of this one man.
Mm.
And so he said, you need to go to the United States. And, I did my PhD on bacterial endotoxins, and that was when cytokines became, discovered. And so Charles Di Novello and Cerami and Bruce Beutler and whatever. And so I became there, and then I came in the United States, and I was actually accustomed to the European sort of thing. Like, you know, you said, well, it would be really neat if we would do this or that, and everybody would say, yeah, but you know, the risk, or who says it will succeed, or you cannot do that, or whatever. And then I came in New York at Rockefeller, and it was like, okay, so yeah, this sounds like a nice idea, you know. We you know, new, and what can we do? You know, what do you need? And that's how it went there. You know, there were also struggles to get into the lab. You know, we really had to fight for a bench. But on the other hand, you know, people were really supportive in basically saying, yeah, you know, sounds like a really interesting idea. How could it be done? And so that changed my mind, and I never forgot about that.
How could it work versus how can it not work?
Exactly. Why it would not work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's nice. And I guess you kept some of this mindset, even though you returned to Europe.
Absolutely.
You kept it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I could, I can second this. And I mean, I was 1 year in Boston to finish my master's, and same, especially in Boston, especially like it was 2013, 2014 was an amazing energy vibe, everything. And I learned also a lot from there. Maybe just from the last point, which also fascinates me as an entrepreneur as well, is that you still have like crazy amount of energy to go again and to build again a company. It's so difficult in any kind of company, but in biotech it's so complicated. I guess from what you said, there is impact behind and there's a lot of motivation, but can you expand a bit there on like how do you manage to just still keep going and then going again?
Well, I do not really have an answer for that, but you know, there's a couple of things. I very rapidly get bored, you know, also here at the universities in the Netherlands, you get compulsory retirement.
Yeah.
So I was just basically very friendly in a manner actually told to not to show up any longer. They were really kind. I mean, they were really, you know, they were, but they have to do that sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, listen, I had a good friend dying from ALS. Mm. Then two other people I knew also died from ALS. So at some point in time, it came. Yeah, I realized that, particularly also because this pathology became apparent in the last 5 years. Think, wow, if this is the case, then I think I know what to do about it. And so then I thought, yeah, if I know what to do about it and we have the ability to do it and almost obliged to do that. Mm. And it's great fun. I mean, it's just great fun.
So amazing. Amazing, Sander. It's super. We could continue, but I think you are pretty packed schedule. So it's 4:00.
Okay, well, great.
Thanks a lot for joining again. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Trine.
Wow, crazy discussion. It's amazing what he has achieved and what's behind. I loved how he's really super focused on the patients, but the clarity to develop it and really focus on impact. Really, really inspiring. I mean, we need more Sanders for Europe and for humanity. Super inspiring. Thanks for staying until the end. I hope you enjoyed it as well. If you did, please hit the subscribe button. If you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you can also leave us a 5-star review. Any of these actions would help us a lot. And I would also be curious to hear what you think. So if you're on YouTube or Spotify, you can comment directly, or you can send me an email at philip@flot.bio. All right, catch you in the next episode.